It's time to think big with Big Alaska Guests, Big Alaska Adventures, and No Good Lying Through Your Tooth Tall Alaska Tales. It's the Big Alaska Show. Broadcasting from the studios of a remote cabin outside Bolchitna and streamed worldwide at KFQD.com with podcast streamed at BigAlaskaShow.com, I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Stevenson, Big Alaska Show friends. It's time for our Big Alaska Show book review section. We're featuring books with Denali themes like Denali's Howl, The Deadliest Climbing Disaster on America's Wildest Peak by author Andy Hall. And featuring Learning the Ropes, an Alaskan memoir by Mike Gordon. Plus, not one, but two tall Alaska tales to tell. Designed to raise your spirits and not your blood pressure, unless you're a guy named Mike Ford. Good morning, everyone. It's the Big Alaska Show.
And good morning. Welcome to the Big Alaska Show. Uncle Steve here along with good buddy co-host Mike Ford. Today, Mike, Denali's name being thrown around so much in the news, it made me think of our book review section.
Ah.
Two of the books that have themes of Denali in them. And one is Andy Hall's Denali's Howl. The other one is Mike Gordon's book, Learning the Ropes. And so I thought, I'm an ambulance chaser. We don't get into politics, but hey, if the name's being thrown around, I thought, what a good idea just to ride on the tails of that.
Well, especially when you put up the podcast, make sure you put the keyword Denali in there and we'll get tons of hits.
Oh, man.
We don't need Andy as a keyword. Put Denali in.
I know. Yeah.
He's got enough business.
I went back and listened to that podcast, the interview with Andy Hall, who wrote this book, and it is riveting, man. It's really good. But anyway, we've got that interview with him, and we're going to play that. And you can find the book at BigAlaskaShow.com. Go to our book review section, and you'll find his book and links and this interview. It's cool. And then the other one is Mike Gordon, and he wrote that book, Learning the Ropes, an Alaskan memoir.
An Alaskan memoir.
So there you go.
By me, Gordon.
So anyway, he has Denali in it, his first climb. I grabbed those and put those things together because, you know, it being in the headlines, don't you think that's a good idea to take advantage of the crowd?
Very, very apropos. And was it called Denali when he climbed it? That would be my other question.
We'll have to double check.
And does Andy have to change the title of his book now?
I know. I was thinking about that. Did you ever see the movie Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid?
Yes.
And there's a scene in it where the sheriff is trying to raise a posse to go after these guys, these thieves, and he can't drum up any interest because they know they'll go die, you know, so nobody's saying a word, but he's still trying to give it the old, come on, I know you're all good citizens and you want to take care of this town, and I know that's why you are going to join to, you know, go after the hole in the wall gang, and nothing, you know, crickets. He tries again, crickets. And then this one actor, you've seen him in a thousand things, I can't think of his name, when there's just this dead silence, and all of a sudden from out of the crowd you hear, well, Sheriff, I say, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, he says, welcome to the future. And he pulls out a bicycle and starts selling it to the crowd.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And the sheriff is going, what the heck are you doing? And the guy says something like, well, you weren't doing very good with the crowd. I didn't want to waste it.
Never waste a good crowd.
Yeah. Given that, we're going to promote these two books, and they're great books. Dog Sled Race is coming up. You're doing the voice again for that.
Yep, February 21st through the 23rd, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, downtown, 4th and D, where we now have a mushing district. So that's pretty exciting.
How long a day is that for you normally?
Well, the race itself starts right up at noon, and they're usually done by 2. But the preparation, we're there probably, good 3-4 hours prior to that, just getting set up, making sure that everything's technically up to par and that all the reporters are in their positions and they can check in. And, you know, we got to coordinate with the Rondi folks and the trail marshal. And so there's a little bit more behind the scenes than just, you know, show up and get on the microphone.
Yeah, really yelling. How many teams, how many dog teams usually are
Usually there's probably close to 20. I don't know how many have signed up this year. I'll have to find that out for you.
Okay. Anyway, so our good buddy, co-host Mike Ford, will once again be the official voice of the dog sled races, the world championship dog sled races, I might add.
That's right.
Keep us posted. We'll get more excited about it as time comes up to us. By the way, in this today's show, we have two, it turns out we have two tall Alaska tails.
Is that allowed?
Two Alaska tails. We have
two tall Alaska tails.
Two Alaska tall tails. Right.
And guess what, folks? We don't have an answer for either of them.
I know. I feel ashamed of it because they're really good and we should have had a good answer for them. So maybe we'll be inspired when people listen to this.
Don't start down a path you know we're never going to follow.
But of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't start the Big Alaska Show out the right way, brother.
And you go down a different path after you have some of this stuff, let me tell you.
Folks, the key to a successful radio show, especially an early Saturday morning radio show, is a strong cup of coffee. And nothing stronger than Big Alaska Show Blend, the intense early morning coffee for intense early morning indigestion. Made from an old secret family recipe, Big Alaska Show Blend packs a powerful cup of coffee that's been handed down from generation to generation with the same unique flavor it started with. That's because it is the same cup it started with. And one taste says it all. Bitter biting with a specific gravity of basalt, Big Alaska Show Blend. The intense early morning coffee for intense early morning gas.
Pour me a cup, it's time to get up and face the world, my friend. Pour me a cup, I can't get enough of that Big Alaska Show Blend.
That's how we roll here at the Big Alaska Show. But stick around, we have more Big Alaska Show coming up. And you can hear our show streamed and get podcast at bigalaskashow.com.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show.
I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Neighbors Windows and Doors. They're Alaska's window experts for windows, doors, shower doors, affordable glass replacement. Neighbors Windows and Doors at 6251 Tunnel or online anytime at neighborswindowsanddoors.com.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. Here with co-host Mike Ford. I'm Uncle Steve. By the way, podcasts are at bigalaskashow.com. Easy to find. Mike, as we were talking with all the name changing and hoopla around, especially up here in Alaska, with the name of Denali, and we don't get into politics, but we don't shy away from the opportunity to ride the wave to get more engagement and likes.
Why would we ever shy away from that? That's what we've built this show on.
Yes. We're taking advantage of the situation to improve people's lives. So, anyway, we've got two books on our book review section. We've got a good book review section, not big, but it's good. Two of the books that we're featuring today have a Denali theme to them. This first interview is with Andy Hall, who authored Denali's Howl, The Deadliest Climbing Disaster on America's Wildest Peak. And Andy was the managing editor of Alaska Magazine for like 17 years. If you think about it, Mike, what an incredibly rich Alaska resource he is.
Oh, man.
His dad was superintendent at then called McKinley Park back in the 60s when this deadliest accident happened. You know, and he carried that guilt. It was on his watch. There was nothing he could do about it, but it was during his watch. And so he carried that guilt. That guilt also motivated Andy Hall to write this book.
What a nice thing to do for his dad, too. I don't know if his dad was still alive when the book came out.
I don't think he was.
Nice thing to do in memory of his dad.
It's an awesome book. And the other thing that's really unique in this thing, Mike, is it was the first time a satellite phone was used at the summit on Denali. Oh. We have a recording on this. where they're calling down from the summit, and they recorded it in Eielson, the Air Force base there. And so they've got the recording. It's really eerie because just a few hours later, they were gone. Anyway, this is an interview we did with Andy Hall on his book, Denali's Howl, The Deadliest Climbing Disaster in America's Wildest Peak.
Hey, our guest is Andy Hall. Delighted to have this guy back with us. He was the managing editor of Alaska Magazine, I want to say for 17 years. It was managing editor a good...
I was an editor and publisher. I held about every job there was there at one point.
Yeah, I know. I was going to say, well, didn't you have a thing of keys on your belt? And
yeah, I had bags in my back pocket.
But anyway, he's one of the driving forces for Alaska Magazine for several years. In fact, I'd been a fan of Andy's writing before meeting him. And after leaving Alaska Magazine, he went on to write a book called Denali's Howl, The Deadliest Climbing Disaster on America's Wildest Peak. Please give a warm Big Alaska Show welcome to Andy Hall. Man, I'm so glad to find you. We were just thinking about it. It's been 5 years since you were here last, I think.
Yeah, that's about right.
And isn't that crazy?
And we've been using your Tall Alaska Tale.
It's our number one Tall Alaska Tale.
It's our number. It's because it's our only.
Of all my achievements.
Yeah.
I got to rework my resume.
How many years did you work on this book?
Three, pretty solid 3 years.
Yeah, and yeah. If you only knew, all you had to do is come to the show.
Right, right.
What could you have done with that time, man? Oh, boy. Mike, can you grab that Tall Alaska Tale? Of Andy's, it starts out. Let's just play this to remind you of your Tall Alaska Tale.
Okay, here we go. Okay.
Early in the last century, a man named Nimrod, nicknamed Nimrod, lived in Eagle. And one winter he got a toothache, and he was out alone in his cabin and decided to extract his own tooth. And he wasn't, you know, using old pliers and dental work. Wasn't sure which one, so he removed most of his teeth before he got the offending tooth. So he had no teeth. And sometime that year, he shot a grizzly bear and then made a pair of dentures from the bear's teeth and then ate the bear with its own teeth.
And, Let's play that answer. The answer is just as good. Andy, what's the answer?
It is true.
It's true. Okay.
Man. And, you know, it's mostly true. He actually used incisors from a doll sheep, premolars from a caribou, and actual molars from a grizzly bear.
Yeah. Now, do you remember that? You remember telling us that story?
I do, yeah. I've repeated that a few times.
The high quality of the audio even makes it better, don't you think?
Well, yeah, and that was Carl LeRae.
That was Carl's laugh. That makes it even
better. Yeah, we unfortunately lost a brother about 4 years ago.
Heard that, yeah.
Carl, we got him on as a social media guy, but he liked to work the board periodically, and he was learning. Unfortunately, when you told us your tale, and hence the RF feedback, that sounds like Frankenstein in the background crackling. But anyway, that was our favorite Tall Alaska Tale. And we've won more prizes off of you.
We have?
Really?
Let's talk about Denali's Howl. This book is called Andy Hall's. It's Denali's Howl, The Deadliest Climbing Disaster on America's Wildest Peak. So, in general, what's this story about, Andy?
Well, it's a story of the Wilcox climbing expedition. It happened in 1967 on Denali, and it is the worst accident ever to occur on the mountain. So it was a 12-man team, and seven of the men died on that expedition.
And that was 1967?
1967,
okay. Yeah. Why did you write this book?
Well, my dad was the superintendent of the park at the time, and I lived in the park. I was five, but it was one of those... it was one of those pieces of Alaska history where I knew my dad was involved. I had recollections of it, and I didn't have the entire story. And there were two teams that came together. They both wrote books, but they were kind of taking pot shots at each other, and they wrote it from the perspective of the climbing teams. And nobody had stepped back and written a story, or at least an accurate story of the the rescue efforts and the people that tried to help and all the other things that go into an accident, or, you know, that go into trying to help people. And so I just wanted to tell that story, and I also wanted to learn a little bit more about my dad's involvement.
And I thought that was interesting, because you and I talked a little bit about that, because this happened on his watch, in a sense.
Right.
But he wasn't there at the time.
Right. Well, he was there when they arrived at the park. Now, in those days, a climb was not a fly into Kihiltna in a, you know, 7 to 10 day or 2 week climb. It was, these guys drove to Wonder Lake, they hiked in, then they went up the Muldrow, and by the time they got up to within striking distance, they'd been on the mountain for almost a month. So this was a, you know, this was a real expedition. You know, it was not the same thing as what happens today, not to take away from the effort today, but it was just a bigger commitment. So my dad saw the guys when they went into the mountain on their way through the park, but then he was actually administrator of all the parks in Alaska. He ended up chaperoning a congresswoman around who had something to do with funding the Department of the Interior. So he ended up elsewhere in the state for part of that time, and when he came back, this thing was going. There was clearly a problem, but a really big storm was on the mountain at the time, and that tied him, you know, basically there was nothing they could do until the storm broke.
We're with Andy Hall talking about this book, Denali's Howl, a fantastic book, ladies and gentlemen. I saw the price on it. It's way too cheap, Andy. It's got to be a mistake.
If you want to pay more, you know, maybe you can collect it for me.
Yeah.
And stick around for more with Andy Hall right after this important message.
This is Mike Ford.
And I'm Uncle Steve, inviting you to join us for the Big Alaska Show Saturday mornings.
It's Big Alaska guests, adventures, and no good lying through your tooth to Alaska tales.
And we're designed to raise your spirits, not your blood pressure. Just leave your muddy boots and politics at the door.
It's a great way to start your Saturday.
And we're locally owned, just like our sponsors, Neighbors Windows and Doors and Alaska Enterprise Solutions.
For broadcast, streaming, and podcast information, visit BigAlaskaShow.com.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show.
I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Neighbors Windows and Doors. They're Alaska's window experts for windows, doors, shower doors, affordable glass replacement. Neighbors Windows and Doors at 6251 Tunnel or online anytime at neighborswindowsanddoors.com.
We're listening to an interview we did with Andy Hall about his book, Denali's Howl, The Deadliest Climbing Disaster in America's Wildest Peak. And this is part two of that interview.
This is Uncle Steve here. Thanks for joining us in the Big Alaska Show. Our guest is Andy Hall, who has written a book called Denali's Howl, The Deadliest Climbing Disaster on America's Wildest Peak. And right before the break, Andy, you were talking about your dad. What was his position again?
Well, he was superintendent of Mount McKinley National Park, but he was superintendent, but he was also superintendent of Katmai and Glacier Bay, and I think those are the only parks aside from the Sitka National Historical Park, which is that tiny little totem park.
Yeah.
So the park system was smaller, but it was all run out of Denali mostly.
Yeah.
And, you know, so if something happened in Katmai, he had to get on the train and go to Anchorage. There was no parks highway, and then fly over, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was just, you know, Alaska was a little smaller then, you know, in a way.
Yeah, sure. And the communications, a big difference. So this expedition disaster happened in 1967. How many people were on the climb?
It was 12 guys between the ages of 24 and 31.
And how many died?
Seven.
In your book, there's a couple of things that struck me. One is your recollection as a young kid, 5 or 6 years old, and you're describing this scene.
People would mention the Wilcox expedition, because it's a fairly famous accident. And my recollection was always this incident that happened. And so what happened was, it was a rainy evening in the summer, and my dad took me in the car with him. You know, the superintendent, of course, can go wherever he wants in the park, but this was the time when you could still drive right into the park all the way to Wonder Lake. And so he and I were in the car driving through the park with a couple other rangers and other vehicles. And I just have a recollection of this long drive. And my dad used to you know, he's one of these guys who used to whistle, and he'd be telling me stories about the geologic history of some element, and I'm completely lost, but he's just, you know, he just, you know, that's just the kind of guy he was, and he was quiet, and it was just odd. And we drove into the park, and we parked next to a river, and the rangers got out, and my dad and there were two of them, and they talked, and then they got back in their cars, and we just sat there. Well, I wanted to get out, so I got out and started throwing rocks in the river, and my dad walked with me. And all of a sudden, this figure emerges from the trees downriver, or upriver, I don't remember. You know, I was five, so it's fuzzy, but it looked like a grizzly bear. And my dad just said, we got to get out of here. And so we're running, and this was a long ways off. You know, this wasn't like a bear 50 feet away. It was way down. So he's carrying me. He has a hold of my hand, and he swings me forward 5 or 6 feet and then runs and then swings me forward. It just was jarring because I'd never seen my dad scared or alarmed. You know, he was pretty calm guy, pretty, you know, he flew in a B-29 in World War II. You know, not too many things scared him. You know, he'd been through a lot. So to see him like that was very memorable. So we get back to the car. Well, it turns out that it's not a bear. It's a guy in a poncho. He's got a big backpack on and a big brown poncho. And it, you know, he's lumbering up the riverbed, kind of like a bear, but so it's a person. And he comes and he talks to the rangers, and they're all standing, and it's, you know, in a circle, and I'm watching, trying to figure out what's going on. And then we get back, and my dad gets back in the car, and we bring this guy back. He rode back in another vehicle, and I asked my dad what was going on, and he said, well, there's been an accident, and some boys are dead. And I'm thinking, boys, you know, I'm a boy, you know, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And so that was the recollection that I had. You know, I recount this in my book, and of course I'm trying to recall something that happened, you know, 40 plus years ago. Mm-hmm. But there were a few statements that he made, and my feeling was, well, who are they? What, you know, if they're dead, are you going to go get them, or where are they? And he said, well, we're going to leave them up there. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, they're in the snow. And I said, what if the snow melts, or something along those lines? And he said, they're in snow that never melts. And so there were certain statements that he made that have always stuck with me, and that was one of them. That prior to writing this book, my recollection of the Wilcox expedition was that. And every time I asked my dad about it, he would just say, oh, that incident, it was so hard. He had to call the parents of the young men who had died. But that is my memory of it. And so that's what I started with. And that's what I started with in the book, and then I went on to research.
And your research was extensive. You spent 3 years writing this book, basically.
Right.
You had to go search the survivors. You had mm-hmm. to go and research a lot. You had to go different places to get stories.
I spent 9 months writing the proposal to get a contract. So 9 months just to pretty much decide if I could write it. A lot had been written about it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know if there was enough to write a book that had information that had not been seen before. And after 9 months, I'd been to Atlin, I'd been to Denali twice, I'd been to Fairbanks, went to Kona to interview Joe Wilcox. That was the tough one. But
and why was that a tough one?
Well, I had to go to Hawaii in the middle of
winter.
it was a little difficult, actually, because Joe is early 70s now. Joe is defined by this accident to a large degree, and he didn't do anything wrong, in my opinion. But he has been defined by something he did at age 24.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough thing, because at 24, you know.
So he was the leader of this expedition.
He was the leader, and his name was on the expedition, and he was ultimately, in many people's eyes, held accountable.
Was he willing to talk to you?
Yeah. He wants to know more about it, and I had gone back and done a lot of research with the National Weather Service, which revealed a lot of interesting ways of looking at the storm. And what I found confirmed what he thought at the time. I had the perspective of 40 years. I had the perspective of, you know, when he climbed it, only 250 people had been on the summit in the entire 50 years prior. There's often that many people on the mountain on any given day in April and May, you know, during climbing season. And so there's an entire industry that's built up on that climb. There are climbing rangers. There are people who've had their whole careers as climbing guides. And so there's all kinds of knowledge about that mountain now that just didn't exist then, purely collected by experience. And so I was able to go back and talk to these people and look at these, you know, the records. And
also in your book, your description, the weather pattern that took place that was basically a perfect storm that these guys encountered. And the other thing is your description of Denali, just the physical structure of it, the way you describe it, mm-hmm. in a book form. I mean, they could tell it on television, and you could get a real sense of it. But I have to tell you, your book description of Denali is the best description I've read about the physical nature and the powerful challenge it presents. I didn't realize the thin air and the effects of the wind it has. Right. And the storm that took place on these guys, you had this huge front coming from the south, a huge front coming from the north, the perfect storm that hit these guys. Part of them had gone up to the summit, correct?
Right.
And then there's this other group that's going to go up, and in that time, the weather changes.
Well, what happened was the party kind of split up. It, you know, some of the stuff in the process of reading or learning about the incident, I realized why they did some things. So the party was split up often, because when you climb with a big group, you have to keep enough supplies to sustain everybody. So you don't want to get too far away from your supplies, so you're constantly bringing material up, bringing food, and so you'll have people far below on the trail while people are pushing the camps up and up.
Yeah.
So they got up to within striking distance of the summit, and they had a good day, and four people went and went ahead and went to the summit. And it happened to be the two leaders and two other guys. And people have criticized them for that, but they climbed all the way up like that. There were often four people ahead, you know, blazing trail, and it wasn't necessarily realistic to have 12 people on the summit at the same time.
One of the things that you brought is a little audio clip. Explain to us what we're about to listen to.
So this was the first time that the rangers in the park had ever talked to a person on the summit. They were carrying CB radios, and they were testing it. So they had a tape recorder going at Eielson. That may have been normal, but it was a little bit unusual. So this was the first time a direct discussion with a party from the summit to the park. And so this was the second summit team. These are the guys within 2 or 3 hours of this call. I believe they were all dead. And they got to the summit after being lost and spending the night out. Suddenly, you know, nobody knows where they are, and then they're on the radio. And they call down, and it's hard to understand some of the words, but what struck me about it, and this is the value of listening to the original material, is whether you can understand what they're saying or not, there's no alarm in their voice. They're not afraid. They don't think something bad's coming.
And so the person we're going to hear the guy who's in the base or whoever, you know.
His name, and that's Gordon Haber, who's a fairly famous a wolf researcher who has since passed away.
Oh, yeah, yes.
So they're calling him, and the guy on the radio is Mark McLaughlin, and he dictates a postcard to his parents.
Okay.
And if you listen to the content of the postcard, you can tell he's
And he doesn't make it.
No.
Okay. Mike, why don't we play it, and then why don't we stop it periodically, and why don't you describe, because I know it's
okay.
Kind of difficult.
Yeah.
Hey, Gordon, you still find the postcard from the parents?
Gordon, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to send one to my parents. Have you got a pencil paper, sir?
Okay, he's saying.
So he says, are you still taking postcards from the summit? And Gordon says yes. And he says, okay, I'd like to dictate one to my parents. Do you have a pencil?
Okay.
And so he's going to say, dear mom and dad, A-okay, you know, and, you know, impart what's going on, which is a successful climb.
Okay, go ahead, Mike.
Go right ahead.
Mr. and Mrs. F.P. McLaughlin.
Okay, Mr. and Mrs. F.P. McLaughlin.
Dear mom and dad, radio for the summit. A-OK. See you in a week or two. Love, Mark.
Okay, got that. How about giving us a little description of what you can see up there? Tell us how the view is right now.
So he's done. So this is when it gets significant, because there's a little bit of a mystery here. Six guys headed for the summit. But when he starts naming the people, he says three different. He says there are five of us here. And then he names himself, and he names four others. So one guy is missing. And that's a mystery that I have not I never managed to really figure out. But if you listen carefully, that's said in this. And he describes, you know, the what they're seeing up there.
And these are the people who would not make it
back.
These
guys are gone within a few hours.
Okay, good, Mike.
The view consists of four of the guys at the moment. That's all. It's completely laid out. The just for the summit, you can see the wands on the summit. That's all. Over.
Well, you didn't look out like the last four, I guess. They had a real good view when they were up there. Do you mind just naming off the people that are up there right now?
Sitting on the summit. Jimmy Clark. Hank James. Dennis Lichterhand, Mark McLaughlin. Oh, Mark Taylor. We're going to get him. He led all the way out.
Okay.
He names three guys, and he names himself, Mark McLaughlin, and then he names Walt Taylor, who had led the climb. But a guy named John Russell is not in there. And he was kind of the troublemaker, and he kind of disappears from the narrative at that point. And so the other thing, as I said, he's not aware that this tremendous weather system is rolling in on the mountain because he says it's a whiteout, which is problematic. Because if you're in a whiteout on the summit, something bad is happening.
Yeah.
But they just didn't have kind of the experience that a lot of people have now. Now, if an experienced guide is sitting in a whiteout on the summit today, or a whiteout arises, he turns around and runs.
These guys, their resumes of climbing, and these guys, even as young as they are very accomplished at that time climbers, in a sense.
There was some criticism that some of them weren't prepared. That they did, but they'd all climbed the highest peaks, or, you know, I think they'd all been above 14,000, which is about as high as you can get in the lower 48. They had varying degrees of experience, some more than others. But they all had very solid climbing backgrounds. And they didn't have a lot of experience at high altitudes, but when do you get it? You know, you get it by climbing, and what you have to remember is, as I described, they walk in and they go for 30 days. By the time they were at the top, they'd been on this mountain for 3 weeks, climbing every day in challenging, sometimes easy, but always real experiences on the mountain. So there's a lot of things you gain by just being there. And so I don't think they were... I don't think it's fair to say they were inexperienced climbers. I think they were pretty solid.
But also, this is 50 years ago, and as a result of this climb, things have changed. And in fact, one of the things you cover really well in this book is the history of some of the climbers prior, and there's some very humorous stuff in it as well, some of these guys. As a result of this, this was sort of a game changer for climbing Denali.
It was. It didn't happen overnight, but it was very clear, and it was happening all over the country, that climbing was becoming a big thing.
Yeah.
And it had been kind of this pastime by, you know, kind of obscure people who would get military equipment or create their own.
I know there's another story in this that we won't be able to get to, but it's the rescue effort.
Right.
Did they ever find these people? Did they ever go back and recover any of these?
Well, a party went up. There was a party on the mountain that was the Alaska Rescue Group. It was a bunch of guys, Alaskan guys, who weathered the same storm by digging in and successfully, endured it and survived. But when the storm broke and it was apparent that there was a problem, they abandoned their own climb and went up as rescuers. They found a couple of pieces of equipment that were kind of in the wrong, indicated that someone might have tried to descend, but they never found a body. They got to the high camp and they found the body of one guy in a tent, still holding the tent pole, but the tent had collapsed around him. Mm-hmm. So he had intended probably blown up and frozen. We're jumping around a little bit, but the rescue guys went up and they found three bodies. They didn't positively identify them, but they went on to the summit and then descended, and a big storm chased them off the mountain. So that was the last. There was another team went up looking for things but didn't find much. But the storm that these guys went through lasted a week. That's what delayed the rescue. They couldn't move. Don Sheldon was, you know, if you know anything about Alaska flying, Don Sheldon couldn't fly. Don Sheldon can't fly. Nobody's flying.
Yeah, and your dad couldn't order anybody to go up rescue because they'd have died. Basically.
Well, there was a ranger. One ranger kept demanding an overflight. Well, first of all, the cloud the top of the cloud that engulfed the mountain was at 25,000. So it was 5,000 feet higher than the top. The whole mountain's engulfed. He thought a big plane could have done something. So you take a C-130, 5,000 feet over the top of the mountain, what's it going to do other than risk the lives of those pilots?
This is a great book, man. We're talking Andy Hall's Denali's Howl. Where can you get this book?
It's at Barnes & Noble. AMH has been buying copies from me and putting them out, and they seem to be going pretty quickly. So any bookstore around town.
You did a Tall Ask a Tale for us, and I thought it only appropriate that we play with you one of our favorite games, which is called
Tall Alaskan Tales. Tall Alaskan Tales. No good lying through your tooth. Tall Alaskan Tales.
Okay, Andy, this is the way it's played. You've told us a Tall Alaskan Tale. Now we're going to tell you one, and you tell us if you think it's the truth or a no good lying through your tooth Tall Alaskan Tale. Let's hear it, Mikey. Filmmakers have filmed virtually every topic and aspect there is in Alaska. Its grandeur, its wildlife, its characters, all have been represented in one way or another on film and video. However, perhaps one of the more interesting and strangest films produced took place in Nome, Alaska in the late 1940s. The subject matter had to do with an incident that involved an outhouse behind a popular roadhouse on the outskirts of town. The outhouse was affectionately referred to as Ed's Bucksnort Palace, a reference to a regular patron who frequented the roadhouse and evidently had a noisy affinity to spend even more time in the little house out back. One day, Nome City Council determined the outhouse posed a health hazard to the good citizens of Nome, sending a constable to condemn and close it down. Outraged by this action, the owners and patrons of the roadhouse pushed back, citing by removing the outhouse, the closest facility for relief was over a mile down the road behind the general store, or a bush, whichever comes first. Besides, they argued, Nome and the palace contents are frozen most of the year. To which the council pointed out, if you're downwind, it's a thaw that'll kill you. The feud caught the attention of the Nome newspaper, as well as the eye of a young filmmaker by the name of Bill Bacon, who had just come to Alaska after being discharged from the service. Bill created a mini documentary in a World War II news style format made famous by the legendary newsman Lowell Thomas. Bill titled his film The Attack of the Little Shack Out Back. Is this a truth or a no good lying through your tooth Tall Alaska Tale? All right. I mean, you got over 17 years of Alaska magazine stories under your belt, pal.
So. Well, I know Bill Bacon, and I think I've read something about that. I think it's true.
We didn't come up with an answer.
No, we didn't come up with an answer. But it's do you have the loser thing there?
Oh, it's not true. Wow.
Yeah, you're.
Well, that's harsh, isn't it?
It's a harsh. Yeah, I don't know where he came up with that. Actually, I dedicate that to Ed Koontz.
There you go.
You threw enough reality in there to throw me off. Because Bill was up here forever making movies.
He was sent up here by Walt Disney. We've got a great interview with him.
Yeah.
Andy Hall is going to be helping us for our Big Alaska Show newsletter and our new website we're working on right now. It's called Andy Hall's Denali's Howl, The Deadliest Climbing Disaster in America's Wildest Peak. We've just touched the tip of this. It's a fantastic read. It's got great pictures in it. Remarkable story. Hey, Andy Hall, I'm sorry it's going by so quick, man.
And hey, thanks for having me.
Let's give a warm Big Alaska Show thank you and much success to Andy Hall. And go get your Denali's Howl, The Deadliest Climbing Disaster in America's Wildest Peak.
You can find Andy's book in our BigAlaskaShow.com book review section.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show.
I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Neighbors Windows and Doors. They're Alaska's window experts for windows, doors, shower doors, affordable glass replacement. Neighbors Windows and Doors at 6251 Tunnel or online anytime at neighborswindowsanddoors.com.
And thanks for joining us on the Big Alaska Show. I'm Uncle Steve, along with co-host Mike Ford. We're featuring a couple of books you'll find on our book review section at BigAlaskaShow.com, and these books deal with the topic of Denali. Now, this next book was written by Mike Gordon. It's called Learning the Ropes, an Alaskan Memoir. And Mike had opened up a hole-in-the-wall saloon prior to the Alaska Pipeline, but when the pipeline came in, it poured billions of dollars into the economy, And Chilkoot Charlie's became this world-renowned saloon that if you came to Anchorage to visit friends, you would always be taken to Chilkoot Charlie's. Mike made tons of money, but also got wrapped up in drugs and alcohol until his wife put the kibosh on it. And for Mike's recovery, he made the goal of climbing the 7 tallest peaks in 7 continents. And so this is a clip from a podcast you can find along with his book at BigAlaskaShow.com in our book review section. So this is Mike Gordon.
Mike Gordon, who's written a book called Learning the Ropes, an Alaskan Memoir. When you first started mountain climbing, you'd been smoking cigarettes, you were coming off drug addiction. I mean, you're not a svelte young man. How old were you when you started doing your training to mountain climb?
46.
You started on Flat Top, which Flat Top is a mountain here in the Anchorage area that it reminds me of Encounters of the Third Kind, you know, that butte. And so you started practicing on that. Did you have in mind to climb Denali?
Yes. Yes, I had made up my mind to climb Denali, and I chose Flat Top because it's right there in the backyard as a training mountain. And when you climb it during the winter, it's pretty authentic. You know, it's be pretty deep snow. It's pretty steep. Yeah, it's perfect training mountain if you live in Anchorage.
Just so you know, I heard Vern Tejas speak one time at one of our roundtable sports luncheons, and we said to him, "Hey, Vern, did you ever climb Flat Top?" And he said, "No." We immediately lost our respect. You ended up running how many marathons?
I completed 15.
Were you also running at that time?
Yes. Yeah, I was in pretty good shape. But I tell you, you can't be in too good a shape to climb Denali. You can't overtrain for it. And having never climbed another mountain except Flat Top, I had absolutely no idea what to expect. I wanted it to be a sort of a purgatory for me. I wanted to change my life with it, and boy, it measured up to everything.
So people know you've done 7 summits. Will you name the mountains that you climbed, these 7 summits?
Yeah, it's the highest mountain on each continent. Denali is the one on the North American continent. Aconcagua is the one that's on the South American continent. It's the tallest mountain in the western or southern hemisphere. Mount Vinson in Antarctica, Elbrus in Russia. It's the tallest mountain in geographic Russia, the tallest mountain, in geographic Europe. The tallest mountain in actual political Europe is Mount Blanc. The tallest mountain in Africa is Kilimanjaro. The tallest mountain in Australia is Kosciuszko, and the tallest mountain in Asia is Mount Everest.
Do I understand that you climbed Everest 3 times?
Well, I made 3 attempts and got to 27.5 when I was 50. And just to put that in perspective, there were only, at the time that I was trying to do it, there were only 2 people in history at 50 or older who had summited Everest.
What was the most difficult climb? Was Denali difficult because it was the first one?
Yeah. It's a tough climb. You know, there's more altitude gain from base camp on Denali to the summit than there is on base camp Everest to the summit. Base camp on Denali is 7,500 feet, and the summit is 20,023 feet. Base camp on Everest is 17,500 feet. The summit is 29,028 feet.
Which one was more fun?
Vincent in Antarctica was, that was the real adventure.
Tell us about it.
Well, it started out with the flight down there from Punta Arenas, Chile. We all agreed that the flight down there and back in the DC-6 was more dangerous than the climb. We took our own fuel with us strapped in 55-gallon drums to the fuselage inside the plane. And it had to be pristine weather because you had to be able to land when you got down there to refuel. If you couldn't land, you were toast. And it was just an ice field that you landed on with a few 55-gallon drums painted red around it. And it was unpressurized. And as you're going down there, you're kind of going up and down in altitude, and the fuel cans are going ding, bang, bong. You're getting altitude adjustment flight down.
I'm trying to remember which one of your expeditions is where you were on the bus and you guys, I mean, it was several hours and the guy was driving right behind the other guy and you guys are just getting, it was lucky you guys didn't get, you know, carbon dioxide poisoning.
Yeah, that was the ride from Nairobi into Tanzania to Mount Kilimanjaro. These little narrow dirt roads, these buses that emitted previously unknown amounts of black noxious fume, you know, exhaust. The driver would get behind one that was doing that, and he would just stay right immediately behind, you know, bumper to bumper.
And how long?
Yeah, you know, like forever.
He's Ford. He was. If you read it, the thing is, they're,
you know, white knuckle driving too. You know, I referred to the one driver as
former NASCAR driver, and he was just
yeah. There's a famous driver whose name I used his first name, and then I called him Mbudo. It was wild.
The way it described it, Ford, was it was like, I mean, several hours that they had to drive with this white knuckling in this obnoxious. I mean, it just sounded awful, man. It seems you had a heart for Nepal. I got the sense just from cursory looking through this, Everest had a special meaning, did each one have its own special meaning? But somehow Everest seems to have some kind of a spiritual connection or some kind of emotional connection, or did I misread that?
Well, I don't think you can help but fall in love with the Nepalese people. They're just wonderful people. And the Sherpa guides are, you know, they're just amazing. Your life depends upon them. And you get into the culture, you know, you have religious ceremonies before each of the climbs. It's like there's no atheists in foxholes. So there's no atheists at base camp during the Puja either.
How long did the Denali climb take place overall? Give us a sense of how many days.
It was 3 weeks. We barely made it. We were going to have to come down the next day if we hadn't made it the day that we didn't. We made it a night summit. It was kind of a risky thing to do, but it worked for us. Everest, you're over there for a couple of months.
And once you finish that climb, do you already have the next climb in mind, or do you have a time that you just want to think about it?
I had it all planned in advance. During that 4.5 years or so, that's basically all I did. I was separated from my wife, trying to put things back together. I was determined to do the seven summits. So during that 4.5 years, I did 3 attempts finally summited on Elbrus, and I did 3 attempts on Everest, and then I did all the other mountains along with that. So I was just going from one mountain to the next. And, of course, the best training for mountain climbing is climbing mountains.
I'll tell you, when I've flown over Denali, Mike, I got to tell you, it looks like a lot of work.
I cheated. I took K2 up to Ruth Glacier and landed with ski.
It's a big, big mountain.
And one of the comments you made is you climbed to save your marriage and you quit to keep it. Did Shelley say enough?
Well, I promised her twice that I wasn't going back. And when I didn't make it that third time, when I was 1,500 feet short, I was coming out with a guy who he hadn't made it either. And he was going to go back the next year with a world famous climber, just he and the climber, and asked me if I wanted to go along. And I can't. So I promised my wife twice that I wasn't going back. And if I come back with a fourth time, I'm going to have to give him the wife, probably. So
yeah.
They made it, of course, and I probably would have made it too, but that's just the way it is.
Yeah, well, you'll just have to be satisfied with seven summits and, you know, 15 marathons.
What I told myself was that there weren't very many 50-year-olds that had been to 27.5 without seatbelts and cocktail stairs.
So that's our show. Growing up in Alaska, we called it Mount McKinley, but we also referred to it as Denali, names which we switched back and forth calling it without heartburn. Denali translates to the Great One,
And regardless what you call it, it remains beautiful, rugged, and supreme. In Andy Hall's book, Denali's Howl captures its power and why it remains one of the most dangerous, challenging mountains for climbers. And you'll find it on our book review section at BigAlaskaShow.com. And to my baby girl, love you, and Mike Ford, why don't you take us out as you so eloquently do?
All right, Uncle Steve, we want to thank our guests for joining us. We want to thank you for listening. And we want to thank our sponsors, Neighbors Windows and Doors, Alaska's window experts at 6251 Tunnel, or online at neighborswindowsanddoors.com, and Big Alaska Show Blend to cut through the early morning fog. Visit BigAlaskaShowBlend.com. If it's Big Alaska Guests, Big Alaska Adventures, and no good lying through your two tall Alaska tales, it's got to be the Big Alaska Show. Have a great week, everybody.